2, January 16th, of the interview of Irving Pollock conducted by David Silver. And we were just speaking at the end of take 1 that you left the commission after how many years at the agency, and my question was, how did you find things on the outside as being different after you were on the outside from the view from the inside, so to speak?
Well, I've been at the commission almost 34 years, and it was really major activity. I'd had short legal practice before that, and this was in the service for 4 years. Part of what I found is based on what I decided I didn't want to do. I did not want to go to a law firm because I wanted to have the freedom to choose the kinds of things I wanted to work on. It just happened coincidentally that Don Regan of Merrill Lynch wanted somebody to come up there and assist them in their compliance area. I agreed I would do it only on a 50% basis.
Don Regan was always one of the smartest men on Wall Street. He went after the right guy.
Well, thank you. But I said to him I didn't want to be 100%. They wanted me. I said I would give them 50% of my time.
Right.
And so by the time we actually worked it out, he had gone to Treasury Secretary of Treasury. But when I went up to meet with Bill Schreier and Dan Tully, who were taking over, I followed up on that. And I think if I tell you a story about our meeting, it will demonstrate what I found on the outside that was helpful in terms of understanding. The first thing he said to them when he was there and they were there was, "Irv, tell them your shoe story." I don't know whether you know my shoe story. So I told them my shoe story. That when I got out of college, couldn't find a job, and so I had a friend whose father owned a shoe store, and he showed me how you purportedly fit shoes, and I went out, got a job the Saturdays at an outfit called A.S. Beck that sold shoes for $2.95 or something. It was probably the most expensive thing that we had. And that store had a rule that you couldn't sell a customer a shoe unless you measured her on the instrument that you used, the name like escapes me at the moment, and you had to give them that size. I remember we sold shoes for $2.95 and had that rule. And so I once had a lady who didn't want that wide a shoe. She measured, let's say, for a 4C, a D, a 4 Charlie David, and she didn't want that. She wanted the narrow. So under the practice in the store, I had to take the shoe with the sales slip to the manager. I had to say, this lady takes a 4 David, she wants a 4 Charlie, and she insists on that. So he would come and say to the lady, "It's like, it's going to hurt you, you're going to allow that." But he insisted they stamp the damn sales slip and the shank of the shoe and all that. I worked on Saturdays, so that was the only day I made any money. And what happened in this particular case was the next Saturday, the woman came back. And she said the shoe didn't fit her. And, of course, we say that I'm trying to wait on 4 or 5 customers at the same time. And she, of course, is getting more and more excited when I tell her, you know, we told you this wouldn't operate. And they said, eventually we had to give it back for $2.95 and take the shoe back. So that night, when I met with the manager who was taking inventory, he said, "You know, we're stupid. You know what she did is she disrupted me. I must have lost 4 or 5 sales while I was trying to deal with that complaint. Why don't we send her across the street the next time to the shoe store across the street and let them have the problem?" And I had told that story to Don Regan when I was saying that if broker-dealer outfit, sometimes the best thing it could do was to send the customer across the street when they wanted poison, as I put it, when they wanted something. So he had never forgotten that. And that story, of course, exemplified what I was finding at Merrill. They wanted to have a compliance thing that really worked. They had thousands of broker-dealers out there. They needed a system that would really be able to supervise them. So that was an eye-opener to me in going out there and working for a broker-dealer firm, that they really wanted to build a culture from the top, recognizing that with thousands of people, they were going to have these problems as they have them today with renegades or miscreants. And so that was good. Then I did work for the NASD. For example, I had short sale problems, wanted a short sale report. I did that for them. So most of my work was preventive and less defensive. I had some litigation stuff that I was doing, investigative stuff with various people. But I found in the people I was dealing with, and maybe it was because of me, I don't know, I didn't find kinds of things that would be upsetting. Nobody came to me and said they wanted to do some rinky thing. Would I help them? I didn't find that.
Well, run up a long time, although it's not nearly long enough to cover your career at the commission, we haven't gone into your many very well-deserved honors over the years, but you made some notes, and I'm sure a lot of things I didn't ask you about. So what did you have?
I don't remember. For the part of the stuff is, you know, you asked me about cases. And I think one of the cases that came to mind in showing what we were able to accomplish was in the interpositioning area. Remember the, was it Delaware management case?
Yeah.
We had that. And so that was an important thing. Then one of the first criminal prosecutions was the Crosby case. That had just involved a guy who was setting up a corrupt mutual fund, as I recall. But, you know, the interesting thing is you don't have many criminal cases in the mutual fund area. The system has really worked there. And I don't know, you probably have a better knowledge than I do as to why it has worked so effectively. I think part of it was due to your organization that instilled that same kind of culture in the IC. I had more of a non-trade association and a more regulatory atmosphere, although your members may resent that description. When I used to go and listen to your speeches, they sounded more like an SEC guy than it did like the president of an ICR. So I think that's one thing that, and talk accomplishments, I think that that shows how an industry, if it's properly run and advised, can really profit. Because look what the hell has happened in that industry. It's just been incredible to see what that is. So that's one thing I wanted to mention. Now, I didn't mention the extradition case in Canada. You know, that was a big problem in the early days, the boiler rooms coming out of Canada. And we had this extradition case that wasn't successful against two fellows named Lincoln Green in 1954. But that created a better atmosphere in Canada because they threw him in jail up there. And then, I can't remember who was the inspiration for this, might have been Stanley. He set up a Canadian restricted list so that people would be alerted to that. That ultimately became the foreign restricted list.
Peter Adolf.
Peter Adolf was the one.
I remember he was the
guy that suggested that.
He worked on that.
Yeah. And then in the criminal area, we of course had the United Dye Gutierma case that ran for 11 months and established the principle that the length of the case didn't mean you didn't get due process. They argued on appeal. It had been 11 months, how could somebody get a fair case? And so we had that. And then Alan Levinson was responsible in an investigation he was doing for a perjury case in which he established the principle that an answer that says, I don't remember, if done enough times, okay, you can convict the guy of perjury. So it's that kind of stuff, I don't remember all of them, that created an area out there where we were really advancing the criminal law. Here's this independent regulatory agency pushing all these things and with the cooperation of the U.S. attorneys doing that. And after your Ray and Ray case, when Peter Morrison went up to the U.S. attorney's office and prosecuted that case, as a result of their desire to try to set up an office. That, of course, opened up the whole area of criminal enforcement of SEC cases. That was the start of the U.S. Attorney's Fraud Section, which now has become a major part of their prosecution area. See if I can think of anything else that... And then you had, you know, the Doyle Canadian Javelin case that Gene Rutberg had been responsible for, that also had that. We also did something, too. I can't read my note here, but we prosecuted professionals. That Nota Benjamin case, I remember it now. That's another thing. You raise it, and it's so right. Where are the lawyers and the accountants? If you have a corrupt lawyer out there, he's going to do damage by just advising people how to engage in criminal conduct. And the Benjamin case was a case like that, where he was giving legal opinions to people that it was okay to sell security. So we successfully prosecuted that case, and the Court of Appeals judge wrote a wonderful paragraph on the ability of lawyers' letters or something to be as detrimental as a robber with a gun or something. I don't remember, very much better done than I'm doing it. Can't remember his name, but seminal thing. So it's that kind of stuff that I think you'll find as you go through the SEC's history that it accomplished so much, in not only in its own area, but in the ancillary area of criminal prosecutions. And even today, I think, is accomplishing the same thing.
I think one of the things that exemplified your approach, if I can jog your memory a little bit, I think Jerry London told me, who was an assistant U.S. attorney, that when the terminal was convicted, he said, "You got me for spitting on the sidewalk." What was that kind of thing?
Sometimes you couldn't make a case directly, so you had to be ingenious at picking it up. He failed to file a Form 404.
Right.
And so when we were trying to prosecute him, we picked him up. We filed a complaint first, as I recall. Unfair to file a Form 4 report. Picked him up and prevented him from fleeing the country. So we did that in a lot of things. For example, we had a Canadian case involving a boiler room down here. We were able to find out up there who the perpetrators were and got a hold of the telephone slips. And so when we brought him in before the grand jury, instead of just going in the substance of the case, we asked them whether they ever been in Canada. They didn't know where Canada existed, you know, that kind of stuff. So ultimately we indicted them for perjury, and that of course broke the case. Had the same thing in a corruption case. In one of our corruption cases, I've forgotten, this is the second one, we prosecuted a young fellow from the Corporation Finance Division who had leaked in the Georgia Pacific case. The thing, his mistake was that he'd gone before the grand jury and testified. And I guess he had convinced Milt Freeman that he hadn't done anything wrong because Milt Freeman was counsel. Permitted him to testify. And we, of course, were able to show that he had falsified it because, again, coincidence, he had been in a carpool with me. And I remembered on Fridays that he was always going with a bag or something up there. So we tied that in and showed that he had the associations that he denied. So little things like that. So you always had to look. And that's why Stanley and Rutberg were so tremendous. These were imaginative, ingenious people who could come up with novel approaches to traditional things. And I think that was the genius of the commission, that we had people like that who were not stereotyped and were not pedestrian. They always could think of ways of doing it. And when we had the back office crisis, Stanley, you know, goes back to the statute and says we can suspend the broker-dealer. So you get in somebody like Lehman Brothers, a tremendous thing, and you say to them, hey, unless you clear this up, we're going to suspend you. Well, they never heard of that, you know. They got 500 accountants or 50 accountants on the job the next day. So it was that kind of stuff that the commission had. Take going back even to the pedestrian registration statements. They came up with a letter of comment, which had never been thought of. And then you had the ability to come in and get a no-action letter. Manny Cohn was responsible for that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of that going on in the SEC, David. You, of course, are aware of that. That it was just a place that had that kind of germs of thinking, the seminal kinds of doctrine. They weren't restricted by whatever was out there. They'd always look for a way to avoid it. I think that was one of the critical reasons it was so successful over the years.
In this area, I remember a personal interaction with you on this enforcement technique. We were afraid that the Rays were going to leave the country, the Ray and Ray case, after the commission itself. And indeed, one of them applied for a passport. And so the question was what to do. The criminal reference report wasn't really ready yet. It was still formative stage, and you kept on asking Ira Pierce and myself, is there anything simple you could allege that's clear beyond all doubt? And we came up with, under the Exchange Act, a specialist could not take a discretionary order, a specific prohibition in the Exchange Act. And so Ira swore out a plank, and we had them arrested. We're accepting a discretionary order, I think it was from Kutshaw or Leo DeRocher, and that evidence was there, and that held it in the country.
Well, you mentioned something that I think is critical. When you're dealing in a complicated area like the securities area, you've got to make it simple. If you're trying criminal cases, you've got to make it simple. And that was one of the geniuses of Stanley, is he could take a very complicated case and get to the core of it very quickly. And you know, the only reason that worked is because of our relationships with the U.S. Attorney. I don't know whether today they could walk into a U.S. Attorney and get the same thing accomplished. We had those tremendous relationships. For example, when we had the Burrell case, they wanted me to go down to Brazil to try and convince him to come back. We had the Gilbert case. Morrison and I went down there. So it was that relationship. They had tremendous respect for the agency. And it was that cooperation that made a lot of the cases so easy to prosecute. I mean, somebody else wouldn't have spent 11 months in a case if you hadn't had that pre-relationship with them. So once we got that Ford section there, we didn't have to go to try to convince them to take the cases. They did it on their own.
Irv, I want to give you a chance to sum up, but I would mention specifically that in a book published about 3 years ago, which won a Pulitzer Prize, called Freedom from Fear, by an historian, David Kennedy, I think his first name is David, went through the Depression and the New Deal and discussed the achievements of the New Deal agency. And he specifically points out that the experience of the Great Crash and the Depression really undermined the confidence of the American public in the securities market. And he observes that one of the greatest contributions of the New Deal in this area through the SEC was to bring some integrity back into the basic information available to the public through the registration process and the policing efforts of the SEC, and therefore made accessible to the general public the kind of information that only the most wealthy investors enjoyed before the Great Crash. So that he seems to believe that the SEC is an agency that really did make a difference in preserving our free enterprise system. What are your thoughts about the role of the SEC since its creation to the present time?
I think it was critical in the area. I would second what he said. I think that's so. I think you have to recognize, however,
that we get cycles where somehow or other people forget their responsibilities, and I'm reminded of Judge Leonard Hand's statement when he was asked about the bribing of one of the judges on the Second Circuit in the basketball scandal. He said, you know, every 10 years you get this kind of thing where people forget and they engage in these corrupt activities. I think the agency has been tremendously successful. However, in any kind of activity, you're going to get the problems such as we're having now, and I think the agency at this point is confronted with one of the biggest challenges it's ever had, which is the failure of its auditing system to protect the markets, particularly since things have become so complicated and complex that you have to analyze financial statements in a way that you couldn't do before. And I think that, you may have mentioned this, but I think Harvey Pitt is on the right point in saying you've probably got to change the disclosure system now into a more continuous disclosure system. At the same time, if you're going to preserve the private sector's auditing, you have to do something to really make them successful in reestablishing the confidence in them. Because you can't have successful capital markets without sustainable, recognizable, reliable financial information of various companies. So I think you're right. The SEC, as an independent agency, has had an incredible influence in maintaining the global stability and these the financial markets preeminence in the world.
And I think with that, we can close the record. We've been up 2.5 hours.